Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday. And here's what I was going to say, which was, I think Judy and I had a conversation of is it possible that this month could be more newsworthy than the month of like July going into August, those 30 days? And I'm not saying that it is, but it's starting off that way, isn't it?
I think we made a bet, and I think we put money on it.
Yeah, I think I will have to go back and look at the tape. I think you're absolutely right, though. I don't disagree with that assessment. Obviously, we're going to talk about what the FBI is calling an assassination attempt, the second assassination attempt on the former president of the United States. This taking place at Trump International Golf Course in Palm Beach, Florida. And yesterday afternoon around 1:30. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. And obviously, we want to dig deep into that. We have other stories to talk about as well. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from all of you on your thoughts. Also, I want to just make mention, don't forget we have our DEI panel, which is coming up on Thursday, and we'd love for you to be in the audience for that. You can find out full information by going to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and a great panel on DEI, and that'll be live at the Linda on Thursday. All right, let me introduce the group, and we will get started on today's stories. Preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences of Harvard University. Has that title changed, Terry?
It's changed a little bit. I sent you an updated version. But it's close enough for now.
I don't have that. But that's completely my fault. But go ahead.
Well, it's okay. I've just taken on more responsibility here as the title's gotten longer, but it's really not important. So happy to be here. Thank you so much.
It's really good to have you on the program. Thank you very much. Jim Ketterer joins us, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim Ketterer. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here also.
Judy Patrick joins us, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. Here I am, the winner of the bet.
And we also are going to welcome Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor, who just texted me and said he is getting his car into a spot and will be in just a moment. So we'll hear from him in due course. So, again, we talk about the security of the president, of presidents, former presidents, and assassination attempts, largely a subject of political violence. And the FBI is investigating the Trump golf course episode as a potential assassination attempt. So this is what we know so far. A suspect is in custody after fleeing the golf course where Donald Trump was playing, leaving behind a rifle, a backpack, the ceramic tile shields that are, I guess, used to deflect if there was incoming fire from, assuming, the Secret Service, as well as what is believed to be a GoPro camera. Donald Trump was unharmed in what authorities are investigating as an assassination attempt. The man pointed the rifle through a fence around a Florida golf course where the former president was playing. I'm going to just cut to the chase here and say that I think the biggest question that looms is, how does someone get that close to where, within 400 or 500 feet, to where the president, former president of the United States, and a presidential candidate is playing golf? So that's a question. How did he know that he was going to be there at that time? And also, and here's just a question that I have. I know the press has been trying to get pictures, because they're very unflattering, awful pictures, that the press has been trying to get pictures of Trump golfing all the time. So they can't get on the property or in the bushes to get those shots, and yet here this guy gets in, and it is a witness who looks over who is golfing with the president. I guess there's an advance team that goes in before the hole and notices the rifle sticking out of the bushes. The incident occurred while Trump was golfing at his course. Following the usual security procedure, a secret agent moved one or two holes ahead of the former president, 300 to 500 yards away, according to the Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw. Around 1:30, between the fifth and seventh holes, the agent noticed a rifle muzzle poking through the tree-lined chain-link fence surrounding the golf course. The agent opened fire, and Trump's detail rushed the former president into a holding room. A gunman fled into a black Nissan, leaving behind an AK-47 rifle, two bags, and a camera mounted to the fence to record, according to Bradshaw. It was the second time in just over 2 months that a man had a high-powered rifle within range of the former president, renewing concerns about Trump's safety in the height of the campaign leading up to Election Day on November 5th. The Secret Service has long viewed golf courses as especially challenging because they are open to parts of the public and near heavily trafficked areas. If you look at an overhead view of the golf course, and I don't know if anyone has ever been to Augusta, Georgia, one of the things that just shocked me in looking at the Masters is this beautiful, manicured, incredible course that is just encased in a strip mall. I mean, it's just unbelievable. You go out the and then suddenly it's just every store that you've ever heard of in your life. But that pristine moment. And the Trump International course in West Palm Beach is very similar to that. The agency repeatedly denied requests from the Trump campaign for additional security measures at his public events, with officials citing limited sources. And so that, I'm sure, and should come up again, once again. Rafael Barros, special agent in charge of the Secret Service's Miami field office, told reporters Sunday, "The threat level is high. We live in dangerous times." As of Sunday evening, the FBI had not yet briefed Trump about the incident, according to Trump advisors who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe a sensitive situation. The fleeing alleged gunman was observed by a witness who called the police to report the car and license plate. Officers tracked down the car on the highway and intercepted it about 45 miles north in neighboring Martin County. I have to say that when I first heard the story, I thought that they got the car just right outside the golf course. I did not realize that it was almost an hour away, which is, using the technology that they used, incredible to be able to pick the car out. Palm Beach County State Attorney David Ehrenberg said prosecutors are working on warrants and a motion for the suspect's pretrial detention. Bradshaw praised the agent who noticed the rifle and the law enforcement response. He noted that Trump received less security as a former president and candidate than as a sitting president. I would imagine the next time he comes to the golf course, there'll probably be a little bit more people around the perimeter, he said in a news conference Sunday. But the Secret Service did exactly what they should have done. They provided exactly what the protection should have been. Trump arrived back in Florida late Saturday night after a three-day swing, which culminated with a fundraiser held by the former Apprentice producer Mark Burnett in Utah. All right. Those are some of the facts and what we know. I do also want to say that we'll talk about the suspect in a moment and his background, which is complicated and complex, and we'll talk about that aspect of the story in just a few minutes. Terry, what do you make of the news on its face?
Well, if I'm working for the Harris campaign, I'm very frustrated right now. In fact, if I'm running for office as a Democrat for any office, I'm very frustrated right now because there's so many important things that need to be talked about. There's so many important issues that need to be discussed, and this election deserves that attention. And this is yet one more distraction from it. It certainly is deserving of that. The media certainly needs to cover this, but it's going to be frustrating at this critical time in the election. It's also important to point out that the former president does receive, as all former presidents do, the Secret Service protection, although I suppose, according to the story, it's slightly less than it would be if you are a current president. If he does not win this election and he does not go to jail, he will continue to play golf, I would assume. That seems to be the one thing that he does. That's his hobby. So this will be an ongoing challenge for the Secret Service. They did do what they actually are supposed to do, which they did prevent an assassination, which is something right. that they almost didn't do last time. So you have to give them credit for that. I do hear continually from the Secret Service for some time now that they are severely under-resourced, that they do not have the funding they need to staff these various candidates in the way that they need to do. Remember, they're also providing protection for lots of other government officials. And I wonder if that will cause Republicans to maybe address this. You know, they are famous for wanting to underfund just about every government organization. You would think this would be one that they might make an exception for. Maybe this will change that. That's my quick take on this right now.
Jim?
Well, I know we're going to talk more about the details of the background and the profile of the suspect. And, you know, irrespective of the what has worked and what hasn't worked with Secret Service protection and the resources that they need to properly protect the people that they're guarding, I think it's also it's important for us to just pause for a moment and say, you know, that we can try to explain this this particular case or even the previous attempted assassination away by, as these are unbalanced and disturbed individuals, these are some breakdowns in security. But I see that this is part and parcel of a broader kind of letting loose of violence in our political system. And this is not going to end on election day. In fact, in many ways, this could be just sort of the runway for the takeoff to more violence. And, you know, we've seen this in other periods of American history. In, you know, the period between 1964 and 68, we saw several high-profile people who were assassinated. We saw riots. We saw justifications for law and order crackdowns. And that kind of cycle, I think, is instructive, particularly because this year continues to feel so much like 1968 in so many ways. So, you know, I think it's not just this one particular individual. It's just not the Secret Service perhaps, you know, needing more resources. We really have a serious problem, and we're going to be looking at, I think, these kind of this violence just breaking out across our political system and across the country for the foreseeable future. It's not just a political candidate problem. This is a broader problem that I think is going to get worse before it gets better. Sorry to be such a downer on a Monday morning.
No, well, it's a down story. I mean, it's an assassination attempt of a political candidate and a former president, and it's an awful story. What I'm curious about, and I think I'm going to come back to you on this because I would like to explore this idea of political violence, and also compare it to elsewhere in the world and where we are in that. I know this is a field of study for you, and I'm interested in kind of connecting some of those dots. So we'll do that in a moment. Mike Spain.
Yeah, I think what you said, Jim, is right on and profound, and I think you've really nailed it. I think what happened on Sunday underscores, you know, as Terry, you're saying, the enormous task of protecting a presidential candidate. You know, we will talk about the suspect, but we really don't know his motivations. The good thing is that they have arrested him, and we may be able to learn something about it. But I do think that that's relevant, but it sounds like this fella was a little bit of an extremist and controlled by passions, and maybe the notable thing about it is when people who have those passions about political candidates, political issues, maybe their own psychological problems, they have easy access to long-range rifles. And that was the case in Pennsylvania with the young man, and it was also the case yesterday. And it does just tell you about when people are prone to violent acts, how much more difficult it is to block them when so much firearms are available. Perhaps because of what happened in Pennsylvania, the Secret Service was even more vigilant yesterday, and that resulted in a much more positive outcome. But it's discouraging.
Judy, we have about a minute, but we'll come back and you have more time.
No, I totally agree with Jim and Mike about this. The other thing, let's keep in mind, a lot of luck was involved yesterday. This was a terrible day, and it was lucky that the gun was poking out and the Secret Service agent saw it. And it was lucky that there was a bystander nearby to grab that license plate, because Donald Trump, let's be clear, he has survived two near deaths. I mean, this is, and I'm sick and tired of living in dangerous times. And it reminds me a great deal of being a young person back in 1968 and thinking the country had gone to hell. And I want things to be peaceful.
Indeed. That would be a very nice world to live in. We'll strive for that. We'll talk more when we come back. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this busy Monday morning. It is the 16th of September, and we thank you all very much for being with us. The Secret Service is under scrutiny once again after this attempt on Trump, and I, as it was noted by our panelists, so the president was not harmed, so the Secret Service did their job in that regard, and that is good. The question, as I said earlier, is going to be, but how, for the second time, did someone come so close and in just over 2 months? The FBI and the Secret Service are investigating this, and the President Biden said just a few moments ago, one thing I want to make clear is the Secret Service needs more help, referring to their funding. I think Congress should respond to their need. Biden is en route to Philadelphia to speak at a conference for historically black colleges and universities, added, thank God the president is okay. He said that he and Vice President Kamala Harris will be receiving regular updates as the day goes on. And just, not that this is the most important thing, but I think it tells us a little bit about where we are in our discourse and about our handling of information like this, of a second assassination attempt in under 2 months. But hours after what the FBI called an assassination attempt, Elon Musk wrote on a social media site and then deleted a post suggesting it was odd that nobody had tried to kill President Biden or Vice President Kamala Harris. Mr. Musk said the post on X had been intended as a joke.
Right, and he later tweeted, why does he why is it that he tells jokes among his friends and they find it funny, and then he posts it on Twitter and the world doesn't find it funny? Well, because he might have strange friends who have odd senses of humor. I mean, social media yesterday was something that you should probably just have signed off of, because it showed its worst face. I didn't see anything other than conspiracy theories, nasty comments about both sides. I had been trying to stay off of social media and staying off of the news yesterday. I tried to give myself at least one day of a break, but I couldn't help myself. I tuned in to CNN around 3 o'clock and Wolf Blitzer's on, and the poor man has not had a weekend off all summer, it seems like, because when Wolf's there, something serious has happened.
Well, first of all, I don't think you should feel bad for Wolf, because I think he sleeps at his desk. And they just call him and they wake him up and he gets so excited and he just goes right in, because he's always there.
Always on.
And good for Caitlin Collins. She was on yesterday, too. But, yes, it's interesting. I wonder, as we look at this, though, of the overriding question of, you know, there's the funding issue that the president brought up this morning, and of how that happens when you look at the broad scope of the Secret Service and all of the things that they do, this, of course, being one of them and arguably the most important, that how they are not funded better, and how, and it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, and Mike, you probably, I know we've talked about this on past shows, but you go back to our discussions for years about the great flaws and the controversies and the issues within the Secret Service.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there have been scandals. You know, one that comes to mind was when there was several Secret Service agents had accompanied the president to Central America, and they were having wild parties, and, you know, there was an investigation. A bunch of members of the Secret Service were fired, essentially, because of it. And it sounds like that it was not disciplined in the way it was managed, and there's threads of that go back, you know, on and off over the years. It's an organization that needs discipline. It needs resources, as many have said, Democrats and Republicans have said in the last 24 hours, and it's imperfect. And, you know, sometimes people will try and find a deep, you know, conspiracy, something that went wrong, you know, deliberately because somebody on the inside did something. I mean, you know, you got to give a lot of credit to incompetence. A lot of times these things that don't work out, that should have worked out better, are simply because of incompetence and failures, human failures. And as much as it's easy to criticize the Secret Service agents, I mean, they're only human, and there's an awful lot of opportunity out there for people who are perhaps motivated by strange demons that they have, and the availability of, you know, weaponry to carry out their deepest, darkest, thoughts.
It's the issue of proximity, though, right? Mm. I mean, that's the thing of you look at what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania. And why wasn't that area secure? Why was somebody with a weapon able to get that close? And it's essentially the same question we're asking now of someone with a car that's parked alongside the road, a busy road, who's taken backpacks and guns out of the back of the car and going into the bushes.
Access is an issue.
That's right.
But how do you... I mean, candidates want to be out with the people. They want to be among the voters. They
absolutely
want to, and it.
Well, he was golfing, but okay. Yeah.
I know in this particular case, but it was not that way always. You know, I remember the time I went to Dallas on business, And I was a few blocks away from Dealey Plaza, where John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And I had always had the impression from photos and from news reports from 1963 that Oswald was really far away, and he wasn't. He was just like just up a few floors looking right down at the motorcade. That was, you know, very different than today when someone can be 400 yards away, you know, four football fields away, and you can just go in a store in many places and buy a rifle that would be accurate and capable of hitting a target at that enormous distance. That couldn't happen before the 1980s.
Because of the scope and because of the equipment that he had, it would have been possible. From my understanding, though, he could have struck the president from where he was at that degree. But the idea, they assume, was that they were going to wait till he got closer when he was on the next hole, which would have been closer to the fence and closer to the rifle.
He evidently was waiting. He had his GoPro camera all set up on the fence and was ready to film the whole thing and probably post it on the internet, et cetera.
You know, my initial reaction was, why does he need to play golf? But you have to let them live their lives, I guess. Jimmy Carter's need for Secret Service protection is a lot less than Donald Trump's. I mean, the threats against Trump, who was running for re-election or election again, I mean, Iran has threatened him. He has active and viable threats. We talked off air about the many threats and actual attempts that have been made on presidents, you know, in the past. They are very real. But you know, what can we do? Can we put a big fence around golf courses? I mean, it's a soft target. People, you know, if I were him, I mean, I have to give him credit, because if it was me, I would be in my room. I'm not going back out.
Yeah,
this is a scary situation.
And there have been people who've talked to him over the last 24 hours that said that he was rattled. I mean, it was. It's got to be very, very, especially when you have the entire Secret Service like jumping on top of you and saying move. I mean,
to have it happen 2 months apart.
Right.
It will be very interesting. I mean, you know, as we sort of watch the politics of this play out, and I know we're going to talk about the way different people have reacted already, but it will be interesting to see what former President Trump's reaction to this horrific event will be. Will it make him more, call for unity again, as he did after the first one?
I have to laugh.
Now.
Judy's not buying
that.
No,
I mean, I think it profoundly affected him, at least for a short while. After that first assassination attempt where he was injured, slightly injured. But that ended when he gave his speech at the Republican National Convention. Will this...
And he brought it up again during the debate.
Yeah. I mean, how can someone not be affected by something
well,
so
no,
profound?
Well, no doubt. Terry, any thoughts on this?
Well, I guess I would like to go back to the whole discussion about how our current discourse has really created a more violent landscape in politics. And I don't think it's fair to have this discussion without holding Donald Trump accountable for some of that discourse. I mean, he engages in discourse that inspires people to be radical, that inspires them to take radical actions. And if you're going to be an individual that's going to live your life that way, as he always has, then you do have to not be incredibly surprised when these types of things happen. I'm not saying that he deserves that. I'm not saying that we should embrace this, but I think that he does have to take responsibility for lighting the flame of violent discourse in this country since he got involved in politics, and at least I am not willing to give him a break on that.
We're going to take a break. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll discuss more. We'll take some letters as well. We have those. And we'll go into some of the issues around this. And as we look at this day after the what appears to be a second assassination attempt on the former president of the United States, 46 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
And then I got mad because you got mad. Another one of my delightful quirks.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning, the 16th of September. John writes to us and says, it's more than Secret Service, but security at all levels to secure an area within 500 yards or so. It seems basic to me that the fence would be a high priority to make sure the fenced area would be covered. Is that a lack of funding, or is it something else? Then,
well, I don't think it's a, if I could, I
mean, yes, please.
We have to be real. Do we want the United States government to take responsibility to use taxpayer money to fence a public golf course that is owned by a former president? I mean, there's a level there which seems, just at least to me, unacceptable as a taxpayer. This is his golf course. If he wants a higher fence, put up a higher fence.
Can I also just say that, you know, we can ramp up protections for sitting presidents and vice presidents and then also candidates. And, you know, it's all the, as we've talked about, the balancing act of access versus security. But at the same time, I think we can't lose sight of the fact that when you have this level of violence that is loose in our political system, you're not going to harden all the targets. Let's think back to Gabby Giffords. Think about the elaborate plot against the sitting governor of Michigan that was found out in time, but had it been implemented, was going to be extremely violent, and on and on. So how many targets will we harden? How many resources, as Terry said, will we use to harden those targets? And then what ones are left unprotected and then perhaps even more vulnerable because the violence is just redirected?
It seems, though, and this struck me last night, and I don't know if this is, I think it's relevant, but whenever another country does something awful, we talk about sanctions. Oh, there are going to be sanctions. There are going to be more sanctions. And we're going to do more sanctions. And here we talk about, well, there's going to be an increased security. And that could be as easy as something as the Super Bowl. Oh, we're going to be increased security. That's going to be. I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means in sanctions. I don't know what it means in this case. And I would have thought, and maybe there was. I don't know. But as the sergeant was talking yesterday during the press conference, the thing we kept on hearing after Butler was there will be increased security around the former president. There will be increased security. And then we were told at this press conference that the level of security was not that of a sitting president, of course, but also that it was sort of a go-between between what a candidate would have and what a former president would have. And those, and I understand just by its nature of the privacy and security that needs to be done to keep it safe, but it never seems to really be spelled out of what that is and what those. So when you say target, like hardening those, I don't know. I don't know how you do that in every case.
Yeah, it's never going to be perfect, but you could imagine that there would be just more agents, that there would be, you know, electronic detectors on the fences around this golf course, or on and on and on. One could imagine what they would be, and as it is with sanctions, which I'm also very critical of in most cases, because it's just kind of an easy thing to say. There's going to be more security. There will be more security around the candidates. There'll be more security at the airports. There'll be more. It makes people feel good. It's necessary but not sufficient, but it's deemed sufficient enough to kind of, you know, move the issue out of the headlines and say, okay, we've dealt with that. We've increased security. And it's a bigger and deeper problem. But that's a much more difficult problem to address.
Two things that I find odd and would like explanations for, asks John. Why did the gunman leave his gun and backpack behind, number one? Two, why did the random citizen who saw the gunman jump out of the bushes and into his car know that he was a person that would need to be identified and take a photo of his car? In that situation, I wouldn't have thought of taking a photo.
Well, there were the initial reports were that there were gunshots in the area of former President Trump. And I think in the neighborhood or in that vicinity, people were alarmed and were on high alert. Now, I don't know how what the distance between the fence where the gunman was and the road is, but maybe it took him a little bit of time to get there. And I have questions about how many Secret Service agents go to the next hole or are part of the advanced golf course team. It sounded from the press conference that there was just one. I may be wrong about that, but that if that's the advanced increased security, I think they need at least two guys going to the next hole or maybe going two holes ahead to really clear the space to do a sweep. But again, early in the afternoon, the story was that there were gunshots in the area and everyone was hot on high alert in that area.
And from the very beginning, we don't, I don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we do not know, I don't think it's believed that the gunman actually fired a shot.
That's right. That's consistent with all the news reports that, that the shots were fired by Secret Service agents toward the gunman.
We got this from...
I just say something about that letter?
Of course.
Joe, because the implication of those questions, which are reasonable questions, is also something that we already see developing in response to this latest incident, which is, was it staged? What's really going on here? And I am not saying I think we just need to allow the authorities to follow the evidence and see where it takes us. But it's just kind of inevitable in the current political climate that there is going to be half the country, at least, who says almost instantly, this must be staged, and let's find some evidence to prove that this was staged. I'm not accusing the letter writer of that, but it's just reminding me that that narrative is already out there and is building up steam.
I think it's important to point out too that there's a lot going on in the campaign that would make it easy to develop these types of conspiracy theories one way or the other. 24 hours ago, the media was just talking about how Donald Trump is accusing people of eating cats and dogs. The campaign itself was having a hard time getting any kind of succinct message in place. The campaign seemed to be on the verge of imploding. And this type of event completely changes the media cycle and completely changes the narrative and gives them a chance to completely change their messaging. So there's plenty of oxygen out there to feed any type of conspiracy theory.
We got this letter from Susan wrote it and Tracy wrote a version of it. They both basically say the same thing. I heard this morning that it's much easier to secure a military golf course such as President Obama played out. Maybe that would be a sensible change to make and have a few people making that point this morning. I don't think it was lucky, writes Mary, that the shooter was spotted and apprehended. This is what the Secret Service are there for, and they did their jobs. This was a wide open space allowing for many places to get that close. I think the officers closest to him as the second layer of protection did a great job. Then we go to this letter from Charles. Well, Charles asks a question that we are going to get into right after our news break, which is the political views and affiliations of the former, would-be assassin. And the Joel writes, it was reported that the shooter was 400 to 500 yards from Trump, not feet. If we said feet, I apologize.
Four football fields, I think is still that, there's been some stories about experts in firearms, saying that it would have been, you know, possible to get a good shot off that could be accurate even at that distance. And they were talking about football fields, you know, 3, 4, or 5, I guess. And you know, some of that clarity is going to come as I think the day goes on.
But again, the expectation was that the target in this case, the former president, would have been closer when the shots were actually intended
that
to
is
be fired.
Assuming, right, and that is assuming that the Secret Service didn't see the gun sticking out from the bushes, which they did. They did their job, and they protected the president, and evidently may very well have saved his life again.
And Nina writes, the second assassination attempt begs the question whether Trump will continue to support Second Amendment rights. Well, I don't. Go ahead.
I don't think it begs the question. I don't think it'll have any impact on his feeling about that particular issue, because he knows that his base of supporters desperately want to have access to all types of firearms, and he's not about to say or do anything that would change that. I don't think this will have any impact. I don't think this will have any impact on him personally in terms of what we at least see in the campaign trail, just like the other one ultimately did not either. I don't think you'll see any real changes because of this.
And today's question, and I'm sure it will be answered today, is how did this guy get access to this gun with his criminal? He has a pretty lengthy criminal history. How did he get the gun? Who paid for it? Apparently, he had been in financial trouble living out of the back of his car towards the end. And we have laws in this country about who can access this kind of firearm. And apparently, he was able to. So what's the deal there?
Jim writes to us, just before we go to break, Jim writes to us, every time security issues turn their hand, careful, malevolent people watch closely and plan better. Our society accepts increasing violence, and Trump accelerates that trend. That from Jim. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have other aspects of the story to talk about. We will do just that. When we return, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. It's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Our panelists include Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, Mike Spain, and Judy Patrick. And it's a great group to talk about and make some sense of what we are faced with this morning, which is the second assassination attempt in 2 months on the life of a former president of the United States, and trying to put that into some understanding and a context, which admittedly is difficult to do. So the man who was charged, and I believe is in court as we speak, is Ryan Wesley Routh, 58 years old, and who had told media outlets, including the New York Times, that he had traveled and was willing to fight and die in Ukraine. His posts on social media reveal a penchant for violent rhetoric in the weeks after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I'm willing to fly to Krakow and go to the border of Ukraine to volunteer and fight and die, he wrote. On the messaging application Signal, Mr. Routh wrote that civilians must change this war and prevent future wars as part of his profile bio. On WhatsApp, his bio read, each one of us must do our part daily to the smallest steps. Help support human rights, freedom, and democracy. We must each help the Chinese. Mr. Routh, a former roofing contractor from Greensboro, North Carolina, was interviewed by the New York Times in 2023 for an article about Americans volunteering to aid the war effort in Ukraine. he had no military experience, said he had traveled to the country after Russia's invasion and wanted to recruit Afghan soldiers to fight there. He did a telephone interview with the New York Times in 2023 when he was in Washington. He spoke with the self-assuredness of a seasoned diplomat who thought his plans to support Ukraine's war effort were sure to succeed, but he appeared to have little patience for anyone who got in his way. When an American foreign fighter seemed to talk down to him in a Facebook message he shared with the New York Times, Mr. Routh said he needs to be shot. In the interview, Mr. Routh said he was in Washington to meet with the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, known as the Helsinki Commission, for 2 hours, quote unquote, to help push for more support for Ukraine. The commission is led by members of Congress and staffed by congressional aides. It is influential on matters of democracy and security and has been vocal in supporting Ukraine. Mr. Routh also said he was seeking recruits for Ukraine from among Afghan soldiers who had fled the Taliban. He said he planned to move them, in some cases illegally, from Pakistan and Iran to Ukraine. He said dozens had expressed interest. It's not clear whether Mr. Routh followed through, but one former Afghan soldier said he had been contacted and was interested in fighting if it meant leaving Iran. So then there is the more recent picture of Mr. Routh, and also the fact that he apparently was down on his luck. He was he had told a friend that he had $60 to his name, and I guess was living in his vehicle at that time. And there now, of course, there's many more, much more investigation and looking into what his more recent posts have been, and looking at someone, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, a rather complex and confusing history. Jim?
Yeah, definitely complex. And, you know, it seems on a personal level, this is somebody who's dealing with lots of challenges and is, you know, has taken some pretty extreme actions and positions over the last few years. You know, to the fact that he was drawn to the conflict in Ukraine, I guess in a way is not that surprising. You know, we can see that when these conflicts that kind of draw in lots of attention, they also draw in people who are interested in being in that spotlight in one way or another for whatever reason. And so, you know, this not just the Ukrainian and Russian militaries that are involved, and then you have the supporters of both of those sides. I mean, the United States and NATO and the Chinese and the Iranians, etc. But then you also have people who, for whatever reason, decide they're going to go. You know, it's like the Spanish Civil War, they go all Hemingway, and they want to be there and be part of it for their personal reasons, perhaps their political reasons. And, you know, we see this in some cases in an organized way. People go with private military contractors or with organized groups, which it sounds like he was part of when he was in Ukraine. Sometimes you get people who just on their own filter in, and you can do this on the, you know, on the side of the Ukrainians. We've seen people also show up from around the world and want to support the Islamic State and cross the border from Turkey into to Syria, etc. So, you know, when you take somebody like who's already having all of these personal challenges and then put them in this, you know, very superheated context, it seems to me almost entirely predictable that they're going to come out of that further affected and more prone to violence.
This is a question that I should probably have more information on before I ask it. But when I was a kid growing up, it was like there was the soldier of fortune you know, the magazines and people who would go and we're going to go out and militias and so forth. How does this differ from that mindset?
I mean, I think that I remember those magazines and or the idea that you could just turn up and join the French Foreign Legion, which you, right. you can in some ways if you can make it. But the I think we've been sending people off to combat for a long time now, for over two decades in Iraq and in Afghanistan. We're not sending people into combat in Ukraine. As the United States, but as I said, there's people showing up to fight in all sorts of different ways. We also see, you know, the kind of soldier of fortune has become, it's always been a business, but it's really become a big business. And we've seen American contractors who have made a lot of money. We also see the Wagner Group on the Russian side. They're some version of a mercenary collection, but at the same time aligned with the Russian state. So, in a high-profile place, a high-profile conflict like Ukraine, you're gonna get all of this, and it's gonna further complicate the situation. And by the way, in not always welcomed in this case by the Ukrainians either. That doesn't necessarily help their cause in many of these cases.
Yeah, I don't know if he exactly ever got to Ukraine. He says he did, and you wonder how.
Okay,
someone...
I wasn't.
No,
aware
no, no.
Of that.
I've been kind of reading through the stories, and it attributes it only to him. You know, making you wonder if he even had a valid passport, if he could have got through security to get there
right.
in the first place. But nonetheless, he had that passion and every intention. It sounds like of. You know, fighting to the death in Ukraine.
Oh, okay. I was under the impression
no,
that
no,
he had
mean
actually gone.
No, I didn't mean to correct
gone,
you. I'm just, it's characteristic of somebody who's unstable. That's
right.
That they would claim all that.
Also, the idea that as he, because of his interests, and they seem to be all over the place. We've also heard that he voted for Trump in 2016. We've also heard that in the this latest round he was a supporter of Nikki Haley, I believe. So I don't know how much of that again seems to be a complicated
and how
picture.
Do we know that?
And exactly. And how do we know that? I guess from social media posts, but I don't know for sure. Exactly. And again, is that true? I don't know.
Right. What is incredible about in this case, and there are many incredible things about this, but one of the more incredible things is the amount of information out there about him, because he's been interviewed by the press. He has a social media page. He even has a GoFundMe site to raise money for his efforts in Ukraine. So there's video of him talking. And again, as reporters and journalists, we all know just because someone says something doesn't mean it's true.
Anything from Terry?
No, just that the profile seems similar to those that we've heard in the past from those that have engaged in this type of activity. And I guess just to earlier points, there are hundreds of thousands of more individuals out there like this that are on social media every day, that are probably considering these kinds of actions every day. And we clearly don't have a system set up to protect candidates to the degree that would really help ensure the security of our democracy moving forward. And that issue is going to have to be addressed. And it may require some changes in how political candidates operate in their day-to-day schedule.
Ed writes, as usual, Jim Ketterer is right on the mark. Our entire political environment is currently suffused with more extremism and threats of violence than ever. Ironically, much of the quote-unquote credit for this uptick is Trump's own rhetoric and by his own extreme right-wing supporters. Jim, I mentioned this to you last night, but I'm hoping that we could just talk for a moment of putting this into a global context. As we've been sitting at the round table this morning, We've been talking about both on and off air about domestic and our country's history with political violence. But when you look at it in a grander scale across the country and across the world, and what we see of how different are we, and are we an outlier or not?
Yeah, we always like to think of ourselves as an outlier. It's very comforting generally to think so. One thing that I think is specific to this suspect that may or may not have global connections, but I'm sure is already really front and center for the investigators, is this somebody who was acting alone? If they weren't acting alone, on whose behalf were they acting? And, you know, I was thinking about it as Judy was saying, this, you know, this is a guy who has a really high social media profile. He's been interviewed by the media. He's really put himself out there. And he's also somebody who is, you know, running out of money and having all sorts of personal problems. That's the kind of person who would be an easy person to recruit for a foreign intelligence service and to say, you know, we would like to hire you to carry out this act, or we would like to do this X, Y, or Z. And somebody who would be kind of like easily swayed, easily manipulated. I have no evidence one way or the other. I'm just saying I'm sure the investigators are looking deeply into that, because we know that foreign intelligence services have been very much interested in our elections over the last few years. And it's not just kind of disinformation and misinformation and potential cyber intrusions, but there's a variety of different ways that foreign intelligence services could get involved. This would obviously be the most extreme version of that, but we live in such a superheated moment that I think it at least needs to be explored. In terms of, you know, other things going on, I mean, another thing that's in the news that I think, you know, probably would be one of the headlines we were talking about today if this hadn't happened, is that apparently a Navy SEAL, I'm not sure if it's a currently serving Navy SEAL, was arrested in Venezuela and is being accused by the Venezuelan government of being at the center of a plot to assassinate their president. And so that's also just noteworthy and another sign of, another place that is, you know, having all kinds of political tumult at the moment and is, I think, probably on the verge of all kinds of violence and is looking for scapegoats. And, you know, I have no idea what exactly is going on with the arrest of this. I've heard differing reports, one American and two others, or three Americans who have been arrested. And so, you know, in the wake of contested elections and assumptions that a sitting candidate is stealing the vote, violence is just almost always, unfortunately, to follow. And I don't think at all that we are immune to that.
You know, Jim, I could just ask, and this would be impossible to answer, I know, right off the bat, but what can anything be done to defuse our society of this violent political era that we're in and rein it back in? Joe Biden promised to try and do that in 2020. I don't know that he has succeeded at all, given the events of the last few weeks. What kept it from continuing after the 1980s? I don't know. Was there a period?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes it such a dangerous time is that it's not by happenstance that we see this uptick in violence and perhaps even more to come at the same time that our kind of core political institutions are being undermined by leading political voices in the country, and also by the efforts of foreign governments. And so, you know, I think ultimately violence is it's really not at all so compelling and sexy to say it, but ultimately it's boring things like the rule of law and civic engagement and all of those kinds of
teaching
things.
Teaching history, maybe?
That take quite a while to undo the downward spiral. But what I think makes it such a dangerous moment for us is that the institutions that would be at the center of addressing it in the way that you're asking about, Mike, are also really under assault.
Well, and if Donald Trump becomes president, that assault will begin from the interior. The government itself will begin an assault on the government. And that, of course, is one of the fears, in my opinion, of having him become president. But I did want to go back to the hint of a possible conspiracy theory related to foreign entities that Jim brought up, because I was thinking that, too, because of the suspect's mention of his concern about Ukraine. And I would not be surprised at all if Donald Trump, with his history of making up stories, picks up on that, because I'm sure that other commentators are talking about it, and begins to spread a false narrative about this is an effort by a foreign country to attack him, and it's a reason you should elect me because I'm the only one that can really protect us from this type of assault. And it will help him develop a message, help him drill down on his desire to have us become a more isolated country. I think you're going to hear that. I think you're going to see that.
I agree.
I want to ask a couple of questions on behalf of listeners who have these who are talking about what we're talking about as well. And one of the things that we've gotten a couple of letters on of what Vice President Harris should do, and Susan says that the Vice President needs to hold a press conference tonight firmly condemning political violence and saying that in our democracy, the way you get rid of Trump is you vote against him. If you think Trump is a threat to democracy, killing him is an even greater threat to democracy. If you don't like the candidate, go and vote, because unlike what Trump says, elections in this country are free, fair, and not rigged. And that is from Wes. That goes to what you were talking about at the very beginning of our conversation, Terry, about some of the frustration the Democrats must have as they're running a race. And these are things that are happening along with the other more...
The Taylor Swift, the Cats
well,
and
right,
Dogs.
The other regulars of the of a campaign season.
Yeah, I think the letter writer's advice to the campaign is pretty good. They're going to need to do something right away to get back on top of the news cycle. Otherwise, it's going to just be all about this assassination attempt and this suspect for the next 48 hours, 72 hours, and those are hours that the Harris campaign really just can't spare. They need to be getting full coverage. I think it's also important to remember that in Massachusetts, where I live now, but certainly I'm sure in New York too, we're not swing states, and we're not being bombarded with just the constant ads coming from both sides, wherever we are, whether we're at TV or the radio or social media or podcast, they're just being bombarded. And it's a completely different landscape that people are living in those states. And they're the states that will probably decide the election. They just must be exhausted. They just must be exhausted from the constant bombardment from both sides. And now you have this in the midst of it. It's just got to be an incredibly frustrating time to be living in the states in that particular media landscape.
You know what was really surprising yesterday was that when we talk about every single day before the election counting, Donald Trump took the day off and was golfing. Why? I mean, when you talk about how important it is to get out on the campaign trail, he did not find it important to go out yesterday.
I agree with on a weekend.
Yeah.
On a weekend where typically are usually chock full of events for candidates who are working their way across the country as they try to secure as many votes as possible. I say across the country, in the swing states, but that still brings you from one end of the United States to the other. Gloria says, at first I thought, yeah, sure, violent rhetoric creates violence. But when I thought of Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Kennedy brothers, I realized how easy it is to blame the rhetoric when it's really the easy access to guns that's at the core. human beings bring all sorts of baggage to every encounter we engage in. There will always be violence. Let's make it harder to act out, regardless of the garbage that comes out of Trump's mouth. And that is from Gloria. We're going to take a break, and we welcome you to join us as we finish out the program when we return. First, this and news from the BBC.
I wait for you almost patiently.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on the program. We have about 15 minutes or so and want to talk about some related and yet unrelated things. Related in the sense that they have to do with the presidential campaign, unrelated in that they don't have to do directly with the assassination attempt that the FBI is investigating. However, two interesting things that took place on yesterday morning. In an interview with CNN's Dana Bash, who was interviewing the vice presidential candidate, Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, and it was a contentious interview. There's no question about it. And she was trying to press him on the his claims, the repeated false claims about Haitian immigrants eating the pets of residents of Springfield, Ohio. So she did this journalistic thing. She tried to have him support his claims. And so then he pointed to what he said are firsthand accounts from constituents who have told him this is happening, though he did not provide any evidence. The American media totally ignored this stuff until Donald Trump and I started talking about cat memes, he said. Continuing, if I have to create stories so that the American media actually pays attention to the suffering of the American people, then that's what I'm going to do, the Ohio senator said. Bash replied, "You just said that this is a story that you created." Van said, "It comes from firsthand accounts from my constituents. I say that we're creating a story, meaning we're creating the American media focusing on it. I didn't create 20,000 illegal migrants coming into Springfield thanks to Kamala Harris's policies. Her policies did that. But yes, we created the actual focus that allowed the American media to talk about the story and the suffering caused by Kamala Harris's policies." Okay, unpack that. Let's talk to Terry Gibson. You work very heavily in political communication. Sir, please tell me your thoughts on what you just heard.
Well, my thoughts are, as frustrating as it is, and as much as I dislike him personally, he's kind of telling the truth. After all, the person that has asked him to be the VP, to be his VP, Donald Trump, has built his entire career well before he got into politics on telling false stories. He has learned that when you throw the media a false story that seems intriguing, that they bite every single time. And I mean no offense to the media people in the room. I'm sure they'll have a different take, I assume. But it is incredible how these made-up stories from Donald Trump.
Oh, you're getting some eye rolls.
since the days of him being in real estate have just created sort of act like these giant magnets for the media and have really propelled him to the prominence that he has today. And so J.D. Vance is kind of just saying, yeah, this is what we do. And you know what? It works. It works. It works every single time. It's disappointing. It is. It does point to the media's sort of lack of ability to promote really serious journalism. It makes it so easy for them to just use these stories as clickbait, which many of them do. I mean, I think the legacy media in particular is just really guilty of doing this. And so while it seems completely wrong and unethical, he's kind of just given away the playbook. This is how Donald Trump's campaign operates.
Mike?
I do admit that the media needs to cover Donald Trump and now J.D. Vance a little differently than they have historically covered presidential candidates. And that is because of exactly what J.D. Vance admitted to yesterday. But you can't have a presidential candidate for a major party make an outrageous statement without reporting that outrageous statement and then doing the due diligence to go and verify or dispute whether that happened. And I think that's what the media did. And it happened during the debate where ABC commentator, corrected that notion and gave attribution to officials in Springfield disputing and completely refuting the assertion that dogs and cats were being stolen and eaten, et cetera. But, you know, I think what Vance is trying to justify here is something that Trump has done exactly what you say. It's just making up a story to support a narrative. You know, it's true. A lot of American people are suffering in a tough economy. But then you make up a story about it. It makes me wonder if that book that J.D. Vance got so much publicity about and really elevated him to national prominence, the Hillbilly Elegy, I wonder how much of that was just created to support a narrative that he wanted to portray and how much of it was fact.
That's a good question. Judy?
So the narrative that J.D. Vance seems to think we're missing is the impact migrants have on traditional American cities. But I think what the larger point he's trying to make is that migrants are bad and scary and dangerous. And that is the story that the media has overlooked, when in fact the media has done, especially local media, has done plenty of stories about the good impact and sometimes the bad impact that are the influx of migrants have had on cities and towns across our country. Those stories have not been overlooked. The reason the cat and dog story went so wild was because the presidential candidate from the Republican Party brought it up in a crazy, unhinged fashion at a debate, a major debate watched by millions of people. I also will question, are there really 20,000 Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio? Nobody's really ever looked at that except the local media. Have the local media overlooked the stories about the Haitian immigrants there? No, not at all. This is just a narrative that the right-wing Republicans are trying to push. Whether or not, and to dire consequences for that community, where the schools have been closed because of bomb threats, that any person of color is afraid to walk down the street there because they're worried that, I mean, the idea of herding dogs and cats is something that's very, you know, very dear to Americans, no matter of all ilk. And so this is so dangerous to people. And again, the story that J.D. Vance says we're all overlooking perhaps isn't a story at all.
And to go back to my downer theme of the morning, this is yet another example, too, Judy, you're talking about the impact on the community, the real-world impact. And I hope it doesn't happen, but it just seems like it's a matter of time until some unhinged person feels like they're on a righteous cause and they show up in Springfield to protect the dogs and the cats from these dangerous, evil immigrants and carries out some violence. And, you know, if it doesn't happen, then I think we'll just be lucky. And if it's not Springfield now, or if it's not Aurora at some point or some other place, this the impact in this superheated environment of these stories is real. I also just have to say that, you know, if my cat didn't come home for the time that I expected, I don't think the first person I would call would be my United States senator. But apparently some people decide that they need to call Senator Vance's office to retrieve Fluffy. Yeah.
I think it's noteworthy, too, that the governor, Mike DeWine, who is a Republican, has flatly refuted all of these assertions and notes that the immigrants from Haiti who have resettled in Springfield are doing so legally under a program by the United States to give safe haven to people escaping the violence in Haiti. And it's been documented, it has caused some chaos because it's a big influx of people, but it's also been beneficial to a sagging economy. They have found lots of work and they have contributed to the community in a lot of positive ways. And that's the Republican governor saying that.
Although he has not obviously removed his support for Trump and Vance.
No.
I mean, that continues to be strong. Terry, go ahead. We have about 2 minutes, just so you know.
Just going back to my original comment and following up on what's been said, Donald Trump has his priority when it comes to communication, along with J.D. Vance, and the media has theirs. And I agree. The media needs to cover these ridiculous statements. And when they do good follow-up investigative journalism, we all benefit from that. But Donald Trump also benefits from when the media covers the initial ridiculous statement. He has learned, and J.D. Vance has learned, that when we get that ridiculous statement out there and it's broadly covered, that our campaign wins because it motivates our base. The investigative part that comes later where the truth is revealed is insignificant to them because they have learned that their base rarely pays attention to those stories and rarely believes the truth anyway. So it's just important to remember that candidates have their priorities in terms of how they want to use the media, and the media has their priorities in terms of how they want to cover the story. And the two, we should never expect that the two would be aligned.
All right. 1 minute left. Anybody want a final word today?
I just hope Vox Pop has a more cheerful topic today.
Well, it'll be Medical Monday, so.
No.
How to fight depression.
I don't know what it's about, but
it's probably a problem, as long as there's
like a cure involved, it'll probably be happier than if there isn't. Would be my guess.
Yeah.
But we'll hope for the best. All right. My thanks to all of you for joining us and discussing what is the state of our world on this Monday, the 16th of September. Terry Gibson, Judy Patrick, Jim Ketterer, and Mike Spain, my thanks to all of you. We'll return with more Roundtable after this short break.